All right, good evening to everyone once again. Welcome to Great Decisions Part 3. Tonight we'll discuss to leave or not to leave the great Jewish migration, sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rab Aryeh Leib. This is a topic that really should resonate for all of us, because we're all immigrants in one form or another. Either we ourselves or our parents, our great-parents, certainly great-grandparents. Nobody here looks like the descendant of anyone who came on the Mayflower. Correct me if I'm wrong. So that means at a certain point, one of our ancestors uprooted himself or herself to carve out a new destiny in an unknown land, a land for a time that welcomed new immigrants as did no other country before or since. None said it better than our own Emma Lazarus, the New York-born Jewish poet. She died very young, died age 37, whose sonnet, The New Colossus, was selected to be featured on the Statue of Liberty at its dedication in 1886. She wrote it in 1883, moved by the plight of the Jews in Europe. She actually became a very big Zionist and much in favor of creating a Jewish homeland in Israel. And she wrote it for the statue itself, Lady Liberty, and I quote, the end is more familiar than the beginning. Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Now, this actually was chosen out of a group of other nominees to be inscribed on the Statue of Liberty. Most likely, the immigrants could have done without the wretched refuse comment. Maybe she didn't mean everyone. Nor was the desire to open up American shores to millions of the homeless, tempest-tossed, universally shared. Certainly not by all Americans, but even not all American Jews. But they did come in huge numbers. In 1880, the U.S. population was about 50 million people. In the next 40 years, until around 1920, more than 15 million immigrants came to these shores, meaning 30% of the existing population, of which of the 15 million, close to 2.5, even more than 2.5 million were Jews. Looked at another way, in 1880, the Jewish population of America was 250,000 Jews. In 40 years, 10 times as many Jews came here. Looked at still another way, of the 250,000 Jews in America in 1880, only about 50,000 came from Central Europe or Eastern Europe. And many of these had come German Jews in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. But most, like the first Jews in America, already in the 1600s, and until this influx, were Sephardic Jews. Emma Lazarus was a good example. She was from a family of Sephardic Jews, originally from Portugal. Like, her mother was related to Benjamin Cardoza, who was much younger than them. The face of American Jewry, therefore, would forever change, with the bulk of the new arrivals from Russia, including Lithuania and Poland, Ukraine. About one-third of, he's an immigrant, about one-third of European Jews left. So I saw him in the Beis Medrash, he's just coming to hear the class. About one-third of European Jews left, with 80% going to America. Of the far more numerous non-Jews who immigrated during that time, emigrated to America, most were from Italy or the Balkans, some from Germany, and there were many Russian non-Jews as well. In fact, interestingly, until 1899, only the country of origin was recorded when an immigrant came to America, not race or religion or nationality. So the number of Jews who actually came in the first two decades is subject to some dispute, but the numbers are generally accurate. It was probably the greatest migration of Jews since Yetzias Mitzrayim, since the Exodus, and likely even larger than that. Not all Jews came to America, of course. During that time, Jews went to Canada or South America. South Africa was invaded by the Lithuanian Jews at the end of the 19th century. Some stopped in Britain on the way and stayed. A relative handful, about 120,000, made Aliyah to the land of Israel. So more Jews left during this time, left Europe, then were exiled from Israel after each of the two korbanos of the Beis HaMikdash. More Jews left their homelands here, now, than fled Spain during the Inquisition and the expulsion. It was massive, and our question is why? Why now? Why did Jews leave? And if the reasons for leaving were so compelling, then why did any Jews stay? What were the incentives to leave? What were the countervailing pressures to stay? Indeed, more than 3 million Jews remained under Tsarist rule, even if 2 million Russian Jews left. So what exactly happened? All right, let's go to the videotape, and we'll see some of the highlights. The two selections in length, both about 6 minutes or so. If someone can just close the light.
You can't hear.
You don't hear the... I'll start it again, yeah. I'm trying to get the sound. All right, anybody know how to get the sound?
I thought it was supposed to be over here.
Maybe.
I'll start it again.
Others went to Western Europe and South America. From 1881 to 1912, 1.89 million left the Russian Empire. Almost 40% of the population. The vast majority came to the United States. 2% to Canada. And about 2.5% went to Palestine.
Others went to Western Europe and South America, mainly Argentina. It was the largest migration of Jews in history. Today, 80% of the American Jewish population originally comes from the Russian Empire and its successor state, the Soviet Union. There were also other waves of Jewish migration. Jews, mainly from England and later from Lithuania, lured by the discovery of diamonds, then gold, emigrated to South Africa. Jews also went to places as far away as Australia and South America.
They were all motivated by one thing, a search for a better life. Looking back from our position of affluence in the 21st century, especially in America and the Western world, it is virtually impossible to comprehend how difficult life was at that time, especially for the Jews in Eastern Europe.
In contrast, the Jews of Western Europe were living a life of relative security, affluence, and social acceptance compared to their impoverished brethren in Eastern Europe. Especially Russia.
I'm afraid that younger generation of American Jews, in a very short period of time, have forgotten that as recently as their grandparents' generation, the vast majority of Jews, perhaps 95%, were living in what we would call dire poverty. It was not uncommon for there to be one pair of shoes at most in a Jewish family. And children would take turns wearing those shoes when they had to go out in the mud and in the frost in the Russian winter. Certainly, one had only one garment for Shabbat and one garment for the weekdays. The fundamental economic problem of Jews was that they could not, by law, own land. The Jews were deprived of the main means of earning a livelihood, namely farming. This was compounded by terrible political repression, which limited the Jews' access to higher education. The Jews became craftsmen, shoemakers, cobblers, tinsmiths, brushmakers.
Okay, and just one more. I'm getting good at it.
Despite the problems, Jews, especially from the earlier German immigration, mainly to New York in the late 1800s, were beginning to succeed in America. In 1906, President Theodore Roosevelt named Oscar S. Strauss Secretary of Commerce and Labor. He was the first Jew named to a cabinet position and was known for his opposition to exclusionist immigration policies. German Jews were particularly successful in banking and commerce. Marcus Goldman founded Goldman Sachs and Company. Henry Emanuel and Meyer Lehman, Lehman Brothers. Abraham Kuhn and Solomon Loeb, Kuhn, Loeb and Company. Jacob Schiff, an investment banker, became the leading Jewish philanthropist. And Charles Bloomingdale, who started Bloomingdale's. In contrast to the assimilated German Jews, the new wave of immigrants, mainly religious Jews from the impoverished ghettos of Eastern Europe, as well as the enlightened secular Jews with their socialist ideas, encountered challenges in America's democratic capitalist society.
The Bund, Jewish socialists, come to America. And they have the same problems as do transplanted East European rabbis. Namely, how do you perpetuate an ideology or a theology which has great popularity in Europe and in America, which offers a very different set of values?
Okay, get the lights back on. Let me thank again Rabbi Wein and the Destiny Foundation for allowing me use of their material for educational purposes, as we know. By the 1880s, America beckoned, and Jews for the first time looked westward for the future. But as we know, America by then was 100 years old, more than 100 years old. So what changed? Why now, all of a sudden, the massive immigration began in the 1880s? Rabbi Rakefetz has a very interesting theory. I heard it a few weeks ago, sounded plausible to me. The Civil War and the enhanced communication of the time produced a revolutionary change in how European Jews perceived America. America was always a very remote, distant, even exotic land, and largely unknown to them. People knew something was different about it, but they didn't know much about it. Newspapers changed everything. The telegraph was invented in the mid-19th century. So reports filtered back to Europe through the newspapers in the large cities of events in America, especially how Jews were treated in America, which was equally, fairly, of the opportunities in America, no doubt of the spiritual hardships in America, but especially, he said, of the Civil War that ended in 1865. Now think of the impact that would have on Russian Jews. It was unprecedented in history that a nation should go to war, brother against brother, in order to free slaves. That was remarkable. All right, we can certainly debate whether that was actually the cause of the Civil War. You know, Lincoln was actually a late convert to the abolition of slavery. But no matter, the perception in Europe, and certainly the outcome of the war, was freedom and citizenship for the slaves. That made the concept of liberty real to the Jews of Egypt, Jews of Europe, who were suffering under a brutal repression. And of course, American industry soared after the Civil War. Jobs were available, and they heard that also. By the 1870s, the modes of transportation from Europe had become more reliable, more consistent, and much safer. The first steamship to cross the Atlantic is actually the SS Savannah in 1818. But for several decades, many of those ships sank, and there was not regular traffic. By the 1860s, 1870s, the technology had improved so much that there was regular traffic going back and forth, and the immigrants realized that. The skyrocketing European birth rate after the Napoleonic Wars ended did much to exacerbate poverty in Europe. It was relatively peaceful in Europe in the 19th century after Napoleon's death until really the 1870s, and therefore more people were born. Cities, towns, villages became more crowded. The pie was the same size pie. Each slice was much smaller. So what really were the causes that would impel Jews to leave Europe? First, obviously, it was persecution. As you saw, it's hard for us to relate to the evils of the Tsar, because the Nazis in Ostermund were even worse. But the repression of the Tsars lasted much longer. And since Jews are the most adaptable people in history, we got used to it. My father's father, Olav Shalom, said to me once, I said, how are we able to tolerate the persecution in what was Russian Poland then? Today it's Belarus, where Pruzhan is. And he said, persecution, after 1,000 years you get used to it. And it's true, Jews saw it that way. From 1791 on, Jews were concentrated in the Pale of Settlement, which is mostly today's Poland, Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine, and part of Western Russia. By an edict of Catherine the Great, Jews were forced to live there, mostly prohibited from residing elsewhere. At different times, Jews, especially wealthier Jews, were allowed temporary residence in some of the cities that could extend for a while, depending on what service they provided. Either in the Tsarist capital, St. Petersburg, in Moscow, but such residence was tenuous. When we think of the shtetl, the little towns in which Jews lived, we're thinking of life in the Pale of Settlement. 94% of Russian Jews lived there. And the Pale was overcrowded. It was poor, we'll get back to that in a moment, but it essentially served as a big prison. Except that you could move around the Pale itself, you just couldn't leave into Russia proper. Jews were easier to control there, herded together in one location. The area was ground zero for pogroms, for the implementation of harsh decrees against the Jews, like the Cantonist decrees we once discussed it a few years ago, Tsar Nicholas I, whose Jewish children, beginning at age 12, were forcibly conscripted into the Tsar's army for up to 25 years. And Jewish communities had to provide a quota. Children were kidnapped. Wealthy Jews would buy their own children's way to freedom, and other children, the children of the poor, of the widows, would be chach by Jews known as choppers, who would take them to the Tsar's army. So think about it. You're forced out of your home when you're 12. You don't come back till you're 37. What type of life do you have? What type of Jewish life do you have? And the Tsar realized that. Or the quotas that barred or limited Jewish admission to high school or universities. or the economic repression in which the law limited how Jews could earn money, what jobs they could have, whether they could own land, as you saw, and all this against the backdrop in which the Russian Orthodox Church, with the Tsar's active support, were constantly trying to intimidate or coerce Jews into conversion to Russian Orthodoxy. At a later date, it's already early 20th century, and after many Jews had already emigrated, Konstantin Pobdonutsev, who was the procurator of the Russian Church, would articulate the Tsar's official policy toward the Jews, saying, one-third will convert, one-third will die, and one-third will leave the country. If you think about it, that leaves the Tsar's empire without any Jews at all. The tipping point came in 1881, so the evil Nicholas I had been succeeded as Tsar by his son, Alexander II, in 1855, and Alexander, while no tzaddik, was a relative tzaddik compared to his father. He was considerably more benevolent than his father, and he's Zohar L'Tov. The Jews spoke of him very fondly. He abolished the Cantonist decrees. He limited military service to 5 years. He relaxed somewhat the quota on university admissions for Jews. He even freed the serfs, which allowed Jews to move to the cities. Nonetheless, his liberalism angered both the traditionalists who thought he went too far and the radicals who thought he did not go far enough. He had just approved plans to create a Duma, a parliament, when tragedy struck on March 13, 1881. Alexander II was assassinated when a bomb was thrown at his carriage in St. Petersburg. The killers were from a radical group called the Narodnaya Volya, the People's Will. His son, Alexander III, succeeded him. He immediately canceled plans for the Duma. There's no Jewish connection as such. Jews are faring well, relatively, again, under Alexander II. They mourned his death. The night after he was killed, it was actually Purim. For one of the conspirators was a leftist Jewish woman who was pregnant, named Hesia Helfman, and she became the symbol of Jewish treachery to all those who wanted to kill Jews. Of all the conspirators, she was the only one not executed because she was pregnant. Note the sensitivity that they had. But within a month, across Russia, especially southern Russia, brutal pogroms broke out, as always, government-sponsored but denied. Jews were murdered by the dozens. Jewish women were raped. Jewish homes and businesses and schools were burnt down to the ground. Thousands were homeless. It happened in town after town, and it really lasted 3 years. It was a depressing time because after Alexander II's reign, Jews expected, or hoped at least, that Russia would follow the way of Western Europe and give more and more rights to Jews and protect Jews. In fact, the opposite happened. The liberalization ended for good, and new anti-Jewish laws were enacted. More restrictions on Jewish movements. Restrictions on the number of Jews in professions, whether doctors or lawyers. On business, Jews were not allowed to trade on Sundays anymore, the Christian Sabbath. So therefore, Jews can only work maximum 5 days a week. What a harsh decree, like here in Bergen County. Jews started to realize that there was no long-term future in Russia, and if they could leave, they would leave. It was then, in 1881, that the Chovei Tzion began their movement to Israel, founding the next year the first town in Israel, Rishon LeZion. But many more Jews looked west, and the process repeated itself in the 1890s, when Jews were formally expelled from Moscow, after the Kishinev pogrom in 1903, after revolt against the Tsar in 1905, when the Russo-Japanese War ended. Jews saw, finally, that the emancipation, the enlightenment, the benign treatment that Jews were finding in Western Europe would never manifest in Russia. It was hopeless. Irving Howe writes that Jewish life in Russia, Tsarist Russia, was prolonged repression and intervals of relaxation. Second reason is poverty. As you saw in the clip, we tend to romanticize the shtetl, but most Jews live in unbearable poverty. that was exacerbated by economic repression. And there was real hunger. People actually died of starvation. There are accounts, I read in one of the books, in Vilna in the late 1880s, of a tailor just dying in his shop of starvation because there was no food. Merchants were slightly more successful. The Jews had limited means of upward mobility. They were artisans, they were craftsmen in the towns and villages, tailors, cobblers, blacksmiths, but they dealt with a very limited population. If there was one pair of shoes per family, so how much could a shoemaker really earn? Some Jews subsisted on water and bread every day. Meat in many towns was a rarity, even on Shabbos. It was a grueling poverty that in some places in the late 19th century reached 50% of the population that needed assistance from a gemach just in order to survive. Al writes that there was a social strata also in the shtetlach. It was essentially the poor and the hopelessly poor. Those were the two groups. And that really was the key, the hopelessness. Between the dire poverty and the bitter persecution, there was no possibility of change, of a better life. And there's a third reason as well. It's minor comparatively, but as the world became more and more familiar to them for the first time, remember the Haskalah brought literature into the Jewish world, newspapers, magazines, books. Jews began to learn about the outside world for the first time. Young people especially gained a desire for adventure, to leave the pale, to try something new and different and maybe better. This often provoked angry discussions in families with parents pleading with their children not to leave, the elderly afraid to be left alone, and their children yearning to breathe free. The very first article of a young historian named Simon Dubnow became much famous in the 20th century. The very first article he published in the 1880s was entitled The Question of the Day. And the question of the day for Russian Jews was to leave or not to leave. And the children had heard stories and received letters, sometimes overly rosy, about life in America. Some things were true. It was a land of opportunity. Some things were not true. The streets were not paved with gold. But no matter, it was different. It represented some hope in the bleakness of their lives. There was another factor also. There was a breakdown in the Jewish community in the wake of the Enlightenment. The sense of community that Jews always had, of families, of kehilos, of rabbonim, because of the Haskalah, the Enlightenment, the emancipation movement, that ended. And Jews began to seek their own destinies outside the framework of the community. To leave the ghetto, for many, meant to leave Europe entirely. So who came and when did they come? The immigration is not really monolithic. It's two separate stages. Jewish immigration thus differed from that of other groups. The non-Jews who came, and again they outnumbered the Jews maybe by 6-7 to 1, the non-Jews who came were mostly male adults looking for work. Not so with Jews. To give one example, from 1899 to 1910, 1 million Jews entered the United States. Of the 1 million Jews, 57% were male, but 43% were female, and a full quarter were children under the age of 14. There weren't many children coming among the other immigrants. Unlike other groups, Jews were younger. Jews had more children. Jews were more likely to come in families. Unlike other groups, Jews intended to stay permanently, not to earn money and to go back home to Italy or to Serbia. Unlike other groups, at least during that decade, the first of the 20th century, the Jews who came had a higher proportion of skilled laborers and a lower proportion of unskilled laborers. Indeed, it was a joke of the time. 60% of the Jews who came told the immigration authorities they were tailors. A lot of tailors. In fact, the nature of the immigrant also changed within the short time period. So the earlier Jewish immigrants, 1880 to 1900, were mainly the lower classes, the unskilled workers, people fleeing the Pale of Settlement looking to survive. So many came with no skills, many came with no education at all. After 1900, there was a higher percentage of skilled workers, of intellectuals and educated Jews, as well as older Jews, and they concentrated in the cities. Likewise, before 1900, the Jews who came were less learned, they were less religious, and were disproportionately Luftmenschen, as they were known at the time, described not so endearingly by the German Jews in New York as the who protested this unrestricted Jewish immigration as the flotsam and jetsam of the old world. And now you know where Lazarus got her phrase from, the wretched refuse. That's how these uneducated, lower skilled Jews who came in those first two decades, 1880 to 1900, were perceived. After 1900, the population was more religious, more Zionist, more socialist. Yet, it was said in the early 1900s, of every three Jews who came, one was a tailor and one was a Luftmensch. The third was variable. It was not easy to leave. It was expensive. Many Jews did not have passports, and there was no simple way out. You couldn't leave the Russian Empire freely. That's been a constant for a long time. The most popular transit point became the town of Brody, Broida, in Galicia, which was under Austro-Hungarian rule. It was a town 60% Jewish that became overwhelmed with Jewish refugees. So Russian Jews largely had to be smuggled across the border, but literally the smugglers were bringing some contraband into the Austro-Hungarian Empire and then coming back to Russia with other contraband, and they would take these Jews with them. From Brody, they would make their way to Berlin or Vienna, and then to the port cities, Hamburg, Bremen, Rotterdam, Amsterdam, or Antwerp. Jews in the Austro-Hungarian Empire had it a little easier because they could go legally to Berlin and from there to the port cities. But for Russian Jews, it was a very long, arduous, and dangerous journey, but it was also filled with optimism. In Brody, already in 1882, most Jews for the first time encountered Jewish benevolent societies. So every shekel had help, gemacht, but nothing on the scale of the very first one, the Alliance Israelite Universelle, which you have to pronounce in French, because it was a French-Jewish organization. And they were set up earlier, but now they undertook the repatriation of Russian Jews. It was founded, among others, solved the mystery for me, by a French justice minister named Adolphe Cremieux, who gathered philanthropists from across Europe to help in this effort. Familiar with the name? Yes, there's a street in the German colony called Rehov Cremieux, after him. It's been in the news the last few years. Almost exactly. It was his house on Rehov Cremieux that he used someone else's money to buy, and he flipped it for a lot more money, and he was charged with accepting a bribe. That's the famous house on Rehov Cremieux. But Adolphe Cremieux was one of the founders of this organization that dedicated itself to helping Russian Jews leave Russia. And once they got to the port, the transatlantic journey was brutal, crowded, filthy, dilapidated ships, even some converted cattle cars. It wasn't Carnival Cruise Lines. So there were cabins for people with some money, but most immigrants slept in steerage. There were ships in which families slept in one bunk, with another family right above them, another family below them. It was unsanitary. It was disgusting. The food was rarely kosher. Not every Jew cared. Those who did brought their own. But what could possibly last for 2 weeks without refrigeration? Not even bread. Certainly not meat. Even the water was repulsive after a few days. For many Jews, maybe most Jews, it was the very first time at sea. And if there was a storm, their quarters became filled with vomit. few people who write about their journey write about it positively, although the horrors of the experience certainly faded once they got to where they wanted to go. And the real bright spot, the only bright spot of the voyage, was when land was spotted, the shores of New York. And keep in mind, of course, that most came to Ellis Island, but not all, but the first thing they would see after 1886 was the Statue of Liberty. As noted, the Jews were not universally forthcoming. In 1881 editorial in the New York Jewish Messenger, newspaper at the time, it was after the pogroms, after Alexander was killed, and after the call came to get Russian Jews out of Russia, editorial read, to suggest that 3 million of them settle in America, evidences more enthusiasm than common sense. And it gave reasons why better to send Jewish missionaries to Russia to better their lives than to bring them to these shores. And many of these Jews had become acculturated in America, even prosperous, and they were frankly embarrassed by these newcomers. The very first aid society, HEAS, H-E-A-S, the Hebrew Emigrant Aid Society, was an abject failure, dispatching Jews to places where they didn't fit in, farm colonies in New Jersey, Connecticut, Colorado, even if they were unprepared, and most of those colonies failed. They even mistreated Jews in their, kept in their care, reports of Jews abusing other Jews. In 1892, it changed when HEAS was founded, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, and they did remarkable work. They met Jews at the port of disembarkation. They had Jews standing on Ellis Island when they came through, guiding them, working together with government officials. HEAS became almost indispensable. But, sad to say, Jews were also victimized by other Jews who would meet them at the dock, some even wearing religious garb to earn their trust, and then disappearing with their money and their possessions just into the wind after telling them they would help them settle. Jews arriving at Ellis Island were treated by bureaucrats like bureaucrats, with a mixture of efficiency, officiousness, and sympathy depending on whom they encountered. There was a language barrier. There was a terrifying moment when the immigrant would be examined and face deportation or at least quarantine if they had certain diseases, rashes, scalp infections, tuberculosis. It was much unknown. The examinations were unhygienic. Now you read reports, doctors examining people in their private parts, wearing gloves, but not changing the gloves, and examining dozens of people like that. So, family story, when I was a child, my mother's father came in 1920, my father's father in 1939, with my father, my grandfather, came as a 15-year-old, and he came with his twin brothers. As a child, it struck me, why did my grandfather have a different last name than his twin brother? How's that possible? And I found out, I must have been 9, 10 years old, that my grandfather's twin brother had one of these scalp infections. And he was deported. I think he was sent to South America. He sneaked back across the border from Mexico, wound up in Nebraska, but he came from Mexico, chose a different last name. He shouldn't check him again. And that's why my grandfather, all of a sudden, his twin brother, had different last names. Jews didn't even know how to answer questions. Should you lie when they ask you a question? Now remember, in Tsarist Russia, that was the minig. You could never tell the truth. Should you try to bribe a customs official, an immigrant inspector? Simple questions like, do you have any money, were fraught with suspicion. So how do you answer the question? If you say yes, will they confiscate the money? If you say no, are you then going to be a public charge and they'll deport you? One woman came, pregnant with 4 other children. She was asked, how long has her husband been in America? And she answered, 14 years. Even though she was just a few months pregnant, she thought to say 14 years was a better answer because the news was established. And therefore, they let her in with the other children. Do you have a job? Well, the logical answer would be to say, yes, since then you won't be a public charge. The first restrictive immigration legislation was passed in 1882. Mind you, in 1881, when the wave began, There were no restrictions at all. The borders were open. You kind of check in. The first legislation that was restrictive was passed in 1882, and it excluded, I quote, lunatics, idiots, some apparently slipped through anyway, and anyone who might be a public charge, who couldn't support yourself. But in 1885, the alien contract labor law prohibited the importation of contract labor. So therefore, if you said you had a job waiting for you, you might be banned. On the other hand, you might be banned if you said you didn't have a job, because then you'd be a public charge. There's much uncertainty. That's where Hayek stepped in after the 1890s already, because they would guide the Jews as to how to answer the questions. With all the uncertainty, the Jewish community of the United States was built by these immigrants who were mostly industrious and honest and hardworking and most appreciative of the opportunity to live in freedom. The air of liberty was a refreshing change. So the question is, why did most not come? Why would anyone not come? Why would millions of Jews stay in Tsarist Russia or the rest of Europe when opportunity and freedom beckoned in America? The first reason is something that we all know in our own lives. It's the status quo. Certainly the difficulties of the journey would discourage some, as well as the uncertainty at the other end. How many people, especially past a certain age in life, can really start over? How many can learn a new language, a new culture? Eastern Europe might have been bad, but it was the bad they knew. And of course, not everyone was successful in the New World. Nothing was more depressing than failing there. In fact, in the 1880s, it's reported about 7,500 Jews who had endured that horrible voyage went back to the Pale of Settlement because they couldn't make it here. There were not a few cases of husbands disappearing, running out on their wives and families for a variety of reasons, including financial failure. Just take a look. You find in the foreword of the Times little advertisements of wives putting advertisements for husbands. At least give a guess. At least come back and give some money to your children. They had disappeared elsewhere in America usually. To go back to Russia was an expression of defeat and despair, the ultimate loser. So who could live with that? At least in Russia, you knew what to expect. There's so little mobility back then, most people never ventured more than 20 miles beyond their birthplace. So the status quo always weighs heavily on people, especially the elderly. Inertia is one of the most dominant forces in life, known to us as it is what it is, and that's the way it's going to be. And since they're returnees, people saw that really the streets are not paved with gold and the difficulties there. So better to stay with the devil that you knew. It's another group that didn't come. It's hard to imagine, but it was true. They're wealthy Russian Jews as well. The community depended on them. We read about them in literature. The Beer, the Reichermann, they were able to carve out a decent, sometimes good, sometimes very good life for themselves. They're professional Jews, doctors, lawyers, who'd be allowed out of the Pale. They're merchants who monopolized, paying off the Tsar, certain resources, tea, timber. They were Jews who were entrepreneurs, Jews who were financiers. One of those Jews is Baron Horace Ginsburg, lived in St. Petersburg. He's a banker. He was part of a family that had roots in French financial circles, even after Tsar Alexander was killed, and even after the alliance appealed to him for assistance in helping Russian Jews emigrate, he refused. He was opposed to Jews leaving. He felt that for Jews to leave en masse would be surrendering their long struggle for equal rights, be giving into despair, and he said it would even endanger the status of Jews who remained behind, because they'd be perceived as traitors to Mother Russia. In fact, another wealthy banker, Samuel Polyakov, made the same argument. If Jews leave in large numbers, the Tsar will consider all Jews who stay traitors, or potential traitors, will be worse. None of these arguments were innately unreasonable, except for the fact that the Tsar did not mind if the Jews emigrated. The issue was what money they would take with them, but to get rid of the Jews, that's what he wanted. But the wealthy, the well-connected, the relatively secure, had less reason to leave, so they didn't. Of course, they especially lost everything, their wealth and sometimes their lives, during and after the Communist Revolution in 1917. Also, two political groups stood out. 1881, the Chovei Tzion began. The Russian Zionists did not leave because they planned to go to Israel, not America. And this group, especially after the 1890s, they became the mainstays of the Zionist movement that we discussed in the last several weeks. Weizmann, Sokolov, Kosciuszko, Ben-Gurion, Jabotinsky, Dizengoff, and others, not to mention Rav Reines and Rav Kook, all Russians. Rav Kook was from Latvia, but the same point. All Russians, all Zionists, all with their eyes on Zion, not New York. Had the community in Israel been more established and been able to sustain more Jews, then more Russian Jews would have left for Israel. If America seemed exotic, the land of Israel seemed even more exotic. But this group had no interest, at least in the 1880s and 90s, in migrating to another place in the exile. The second political group were the Jewish socialists. So they delighted in the Tsar's misery. They actively plotted his overthrow and the establishment of a new world order based on socialism. They were the Bundists. Now, many Zionists were also socialists, but they wanted to create their socialist paradise in Israel. The Bundists were anti-Zionists. They wanted to change the world. They wanted to repair the brotherhood of man. America was perceived as less sophisticated, less cultured than Europe. They would make their stand, make their mark in Europe. Coming, and especially Russia, coming to America would have been a betrayal of that goal. Nevertheless, there was a trickle of such Jews in the 1880s and 1890s, but many more Bundists came in the wave of immigration after Kishinev and after the Russo-Japanese War. By the way, you saw Jacob Schiff here. The Japanese were successful in the war because Schiff lent them money. Schiff so hated the Tsar that he lent the Japanese money, but of course after the war the Tsar took it out on Russian Jews. The Tsar, after the war and the rebellion, cracked down the revolutionaries, and many socialists decided to take their struggle to America. And that was where the intellectuals who came, as I mentioned before. One early socialist who came was Abraham Kahan, who was raised in a religious Lithuanian family, who became an activist, longtime editor of the Forward in 1882, but even he did not succeed in attracting much support until the 1900s wave that brought the intellectual class to the United States. The workman circle, that social, the Bundesgruppe, they only began in 1892 to aid in the spread of socialism and help the American working man in the struggle against the suits. But until the 1900s, most of the socialists remained in Russia. And there was another group also that didn't come, and those were religious Jews. Religious Jews, by and large, resisted the lure of the New World from 1880 to the early 1900s for obvious reasons. Doesn't mean that none came. It means that very few came, relatively. The perception was, and that was reinforced by news, that America was a treif for Medina. Even the streets were treif. Certainly the meat was treif. And that Jewish life could not be transplanted into a free and open society. And that perception was not entirely inaccurate. It was a very difficult transformation. And most Jews did not survive religiously, as we'll see next week. The Catch-22, as it was known then, a catch Salem Sansik. As long as there were few religious Jews, there'd be no religious infrastructure. And as long as there was no infrastructure, few religious Jews would come. So it was self-defeating. Look no further than the experiences of Rav Yaakov Yosef, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, RJJ, who became the chief rabbi of New York in 1888, with the Maggid of Vilna, much respected, great Talmud Chacham, great orator. He had a tumultuous and mostly unhappy reign as chief rabbi. We'll discuss it more next week. For example, the kashrus industry that he tried to bring up to standard attacked him personally, rebelled. The people were generally not responsive to him. The small religious community fragmented. He regretted coming, and he was under so much pressure after only 9 years. 1897, he suffered a debilitating stroke that hampered him the rest of his short life. Died in 1902 at the age of 59. The 1900s wave, though, brought more religious Jews, but it took decades for a real Torah infrastructure to be created in America. So just to summarize, from this perspective, it's clear the decision was not an obvious one, nor is it an easy one. Hindsight is always perfect. But the decision was wrenching. Imagine any of us, a young man, a young woman, a young couple, sitting in the shtetl with your elders, discussing whether or not to leave, knowing that if you left, you'll likely never see them again. We know now these discussions took place by the millions with a great variety of responses. Do you take that risk? Do you take that gamble? Do you try to endure life where you are? Do you try to improve life where you are? It's not a simple choice. It wasn't then. Really, it isn't now. Even though our circumstances are much better, but that's the dilemma, that's the conundrum that faced them. Those who came did struggle here. Those who stayed, so their end was not good, certainly not good. Those who came, though, built American Jewry in one form or another. And that becomes our topic next week, Great Decisions number 4, Spiritual Life of Jews in America. The choice that Jews had to make in their spiritual lives, and the rise of Orthodoxy, Conservatism, and Reform. What led Jews into one of those movements? That's next week. I thank you all for coming.